Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we look back to a dramatic moment towards the very end of World War II and talk to the son of a man who helped lead the liberation of a Nazi concentration camp. In part two of today's program, a preview of Fiddler on the Roof, which is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. Stay with us. We're stepping back in time now to a dramatic moment towards the very end of the Second World War. And it is a story of courage and valor and of the rescue of tens of thousands of Nazi prisoners. We are talking about the valor and quick thinking and compassion of a U.S. Army sergeant by the name of Albert Kosiak, who at the time was a 28-year-old sergeant. And he was the leader of a platoon of 23 men who ultimately liberated Mauthausen Nazi labor and concentration camp, including the three women whose story of courageous survival with their newborns is told in Wendy Holden's extraordinary book, Born Survivors, Three Young Mothers and Their Extraordinary Story of Courage, Defiance, and Hope. Wendy Holden is coming to the Lake Geneva Public Library for a special appearance on Saturday, May 14th. And several special guests are going to be joining her for that occasion. And one of them is the son of U.S. Army Sergeant Albert Kosiak, namely Larry Kosiak, who is going to be sharing with all who gather there and with us now on the morning show the story of what his father did. And in a really propitious bit of timing, we happen to be recording this conversation on Wednesday, the 4th of May, which is the day before the anniversary of that important moment of liberation. So I feel profoundly honored on several different levels to be speaking with Larry Kosiak about his father, Albert Kosiak. Larry Kosiak, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Before we hear about your father, can we hear just a little bit about who you are and where you come from and sort of your connection to the Lake Geneva area?
Well, we were born and raised in the Chicago area, and my wife and I joined Geneva National, and we have a home at in Lake Geneva. And we are now retired. Both of us had spent our years in industry, my wife working for Allstate, and I worked for a magnetics company, and then Allstate Insurance at the end of my career.
You are going to be on hand for this event at the Lake Geneva Public Library, as we said, on Saturday, May 14th, to talk about your own father, U.S. Army Sergeant Albert Kosiak, and the role which he played in this very dramatic story told in Wendy Holden's book, Born Survivors. Ahead of us talking about what occurred on May 5th, 1945, tell us something about your father's own background. Where was he born, and what were the early years of his life like before he joined the Army in the Second World War?
Well, he was born in Chicago in what they call the Back of the Yards area in Bridgeport, the old Mayor Daley of Chicago's neighborhood. And his father worked at Western Electric, and his goal was to ultimately work at Western Electric and work his way through. And when the war broke out, he and some of his friends decided that they were going to enlist and went into the service. And that's when he was then assigned to the 11th Armored Division during World War II and went into the Battle of the Bulge, and then was going around Germany as part of Patton's army.
I know the circumstances under which you kind of learned about what he did in this dramatic event in early May of 1945. Aside from that, how much did your father talk about his experience as a soldier during World War II? I don't mean specifically the liberation of Mauthausen, but just in general, how much did he talk about his experiences in war?
Very little, if any. Like most of the Greatest Generation, they just did not talk about, you know, their service in the Army. And the way I learned of this story was when I was studying the war in school, I finally asked him, I said, you spent some time in the Army. Can you tell me about it? And he handed me a little booklet, which was a bulletin from the 11th Armor Division, and they had reprinted his letter that he sent to his mother following the liberation of Mauthausen and his description of what he did and what he found. And he handed that to me and just told me to read that. And that was essentially the conversation. He really didn't talk about it at all until it was back into the 70s when he was invited back to Mauthausen to be a parade marshal for one of the 5-year celebrations of the liberation of Mauthausen, and then he talked a little bit more about it. But for all those years, it was something he just kept to himself.
Hmm. Some soldiers emerge from warfare, in a sense, scarred physically, but beyond that, emotionally and mentally and so on. And sometimes that's what causes kind of that veil of silence to descend. Do you think that's the case in your father's instance, or was it just simply a calm, rational decision that he made, that this was something in his past that he simply did not wish to or choose to talk about?
No, I think the former is certainly the case. He would, even though he didn't talk about it, if there were things that were covered in the news, for example, you might remember back in the late 60s, there was a big movement of the American Nazi Party looking to, you know, be able to march freely through our cities, and he would almost get violently angry, at the news reports. It was something that, he certainly harbored for a long time.
We're speaking with Larry Kosiak, and we're talking about the experiences of his own father, U.S. Army Sergeant Albert Kosiak. He was a 28-year-old sergeant in the Army, in Patton's Army, and we're about to talk now about the dramatic events which occurred on the 5th of May, 1945. First, set the stage for us. At this point in time, on the 5th of May, where was your father with his platoon of 23 men?
They were in Austria, and during the war, he had 3 different lieutenants that were responsible for his group, and unfortunately, all 3 of them had been killed in the war. And they had offered my father an opportunity to get a field promotion as an officer. And he smugly turned it down and said, no, those people have a tendency to get killed. I'm just going to stay a sergeant because my guys and I get along just fine. And he had a platoon of 23. And on the morning of May 5th, he was given the responsibility to go and check the quality of the bridges going into right on the border of Austria there, where the American Army and the Russian armies were going to ultimately meet up, and that's where they were going to divide Europe. And so when he got up in the morning on May 5th, he was told to take his armored car and his little tank and take his 23 men through and just check the bridges so that they could make sure that the troops could get through safely.
Hmm. At some point, he received information disturbing information, which sort of prompted him to, in a sense, change course with his platoon. Tell us who crossed his path and the kind of information that they were sharing with your father.
Yes. When he first got into the town of Lunitz, I believe, he saw what was looked to be a small factory, and there one of his men saw a German officer, German soldier, on the hill with a weapon, and my dad stopped his men and was going to call in for artillery cover. And the fellow came down, and he surrendered. And so he called off the artillery barrage, and the fellow took him to a small camp, which turned out to be the Gusen camp. And the Nazis had turned it over to the Austrian Guard. And in this camp, they had, it was like the sister camp of Mauthausen, and there were maybe about 1,800 people in this camp, and the Austrian Guard immediately surrendered, and he asked for their weapons, and they were going to move on, and the guards there had said to him, you know, please, no, you know, let us keep our weapons because that's the only way we're going to be able to keep peace here. We promise we're not going to shoot anybody. You know, we're the Americans are now under control, but, you know, let us have this until you could bring in people here to, you know, safely take the prisoners out. So he reluctantly agreed to do that, and then he was on his mission to check the bridges, and they saw a white car coming down the road, and it was an old German vehicle that was painted white and put with a red cross on it. And a fellow from the Red Cross in this vehicle had two Nazi soldiers, SS, and another civilian, and told my dad that he would like him to go up to this Mauthausen, this larger camp, because there were several thousand people there. Well, he called in to his officers and explained, you know, what he had found in Goose, and they said, okay, you know, stand back. Your mission is to go on and continue to check the bridges. No, we don't want you to go any further up the road to this other camp. At this point, the fellow from the Red Cross begged him to keep going because, as he explained, that in the camp they had run out of the deadly gas, and Himmler had given orders to destroy any and all evidence of this very prolific death camp. We later come to find that approximately 1,100 people a day were killed at Mauthausen. So when he asked what the plans were, they had explained that there was a cave, and Himmler had requested that all the prisoners be put into this cave, and then they were going to blow up the cave and destroy, you know, all the evidence. So when he heard this, he talked to his men and said, it looks like we're going to deny orders. And he said to himself, fat chance that we're going to let these people die. And he and his 23 men went forward into Mauthausen.
Mm. Ahead of describing what they found, was this, as far as you're concerned, consistent with who your father was? Or was this, in a sense, a departure from what he would typically have done? I mean, was he typically a man who followed orders, no questions asked, or was this in keeping with the kind of man that he was?
He would follow orders to the T. You know, even if, you know, in most cases, you know, even if he disagreed, he'd follow orders and then argue about it later. This was certainly an unusual act.
Right, and that in some ways makes it an even more powerful act that that he was acting, in a sense, against probably a lot of his own instincts and what experience had taught him. He was following another voice at this point. So describe what happened from there.
So when they get to the camp, most of his men stayed outside. They saw this huge facility with cannons popping out of every hole. They had no idea what they were going to find when they went in to essentially the first gate. And there was electrified fencing. So he went in with just two of his men, and the others stayed outside. And when he went in, the place, you know, basically, he's with his armored vehicle and his tank, and they go in, and the place erupts into a riot. One of the things that was unusual, since they were in the 11th Armored Division, their symbol was lightning bolts, dual lightning bolts, and many of the prisoners thought it was SS because of the similarity of the symbol. But fortunately, in the camp, there was a prisoner by the name of Lieutenant Jack Taylor, who was an American Navy pilot that had been shot down, and he was in that camp and had been scheduled to be killed several times. And other prisoners, you know, took his place in line when they marched him into the ovens. Taylor explained to the people that, you know, that, you know, these are Americans, and the German officer, you know, immediately, you know, surrendered to him. But he said he wouldn't really surrender unless he could stop the rioting. Now, because my dad was of Polish descent and his parents, you know, spoke Polish at home, he was able to speak Polish. And because there were so many Polish-speaking prisoners in the camp, he was able to capture their attention. And then there was rioting going on in the kitchens because, obviously, they were going after any kind of food that they could get because they had been starved for so long. And he ended up having to climb through a window and shot his pistol in the air to get their attention and told them that he would definitely, you know, take care of them, that they were, you know, now the responsibility of the American Army. The German officer said he would only surrender to an American general, and my dad convinced him that he was a direct link to Patton. So they surrendered, and he did get control of the people there. And then there were 45 countries that were actually represented in the, or 35 countries that were represented in that camp.
Amongst the prisoners?
Yes. And what Lieutenant Taylor did, he got each of the spokespeople for each of the different countries there, and they met with him, and he, you know, told them, you know, over about an hour period of time that, you know, they were going to be safe, that the Americans were there to help them. And in the meantime, his other 21 fellows were outside the camp. They had no idea what was going on, and the lieutenant that was responsible for them, Lieutenant Larkin, kept calling in on the radio, you know, where are you, what's going on, and they had no idea. They couldn't tell them. They said they're inside this factory. They don't know what's going on. So then after he met with each of the countries, this Lieutenant Taylor had, because about 2 days prior, he saw American planes flying over, and he told everyone that it was going to be very soon before the American soldiers would come in and liberate them. They, you know, he was very confident that the Americans were close because he saw the planes. And they had some instruments in the camp, and he, musical instruments, and he taught the prisoners how to play the national anthem. And after my dad met with all of them, they played the national anthem, and he said forever that song had a special meaning to him.
Wow.
It was just unbelievable.
That's amazing. Can you help us understand what the state of the camp was at the time that your father and his men reached Mauthausen? It sounds like, from what you describe, that many of the Nazi guards had perhaps already fled, and that, in a sense, those prisoners were no longer imprisoned in the way that they had been before. Am I understanding that correctly?
The SS officers had abandoned, but there were there remained 1,800 German soldiers, all with weapons, and some of them tried to pretend that they were, you know, friendly at that point because they knew, you know, that their time was up, but the prisoners, you know, knew who the good ones were, who the bad ones were. But ultimately, he did take 1,800 German soldiers from that camp, marched them down that evening, picked up the additional 200 that were at the Goosen camp, and marched them through the night until about 3:30 in the morning, where he caught up with his main troops back. And finally, when he marched them all back, he wanted to meet with the colonel that was in charge, and his guard said, "No, he's sleeping. You know, you have to leave him alone." And he said, "No, I have to. You know, I have to see him." And they said, "No, you can't." And he just went by him and went and woke up the colonel. And as he said, the colonel said to him, "Kosiak, you know, are you drunk? What you're telling me better be true, because if not, every stripe that's on your shirt, I'm going to rip off." And when he walked outside and saw these 1,800, well, almost 2,000 German soldiers standing there with all their weapons piled on one of my dad's trucks, he couldn't believe his eyes. And then, of course, the camp, they were preparing to follow Himmler's orders. They had run out of the gas on May 28th. And in the book, we read about Dr. Mark Olsky. He and his mother, who was one of the babies, he and his mother were brought to the gas chambers on May 29th, the day after that they ran out of the gas, and that's where they found them.
So the part of the story that surprises me quite a lot is of your father reaching the camp and, in a sense, finding a riot on his hands, finding these prisoners, in a sense, rioting. And probably going through the minds of these prisoners was as much fear and bewilderment as anything, since at that point in time they really did not know what was coming next.
Absolutely.
So once everything is calmed, then of course the process then begins of actually bringing these prisoners out of Mauthausen and bringing them to shelter and safety, to give them all that they needed in order to survive and ultimately begin a new chapter. Did your father have any involvement in that, or at that point in time, was he, in a sense, jerked back into sort of regular life as a U.S. Army sergeant?
No, he did not. He was not brought back to Mauthausen after the liberation. He was continued on his missions through until he was, you know, ultimately discharged in December of 45 or 46. But he ended up, you know, just continuing his other mission. The interesting thing that we find, you know, it wasn't until I started reading, you know, and met Wendy and read the book that really started to go into some of this research. Of course, with my dad, had passed away in 1982 and couldn't ask him any questions. So I do, like most people do, is kind of Google, you know, Mauthausen. And the thing that's interesting that we find, that once Eisenhower found out what happened and how many people were actually liberated in that camp, he ordered the recreation of the liberation of Mauthausen. And if you Google Mauthausen today, you see that on film. And the way you know it's the recreation from what the original is, in the original gates above Mauthausen was a huge German eagle. And the very first thing that the prisoners did when my dad came through the gates, they threw ropes around that eagle and pulled it down. Mm. So in the recreation, there's no eagle over the gates. And we know that that it was there because subsequent, we found a Spanish website, and somebody in the camp had had a camera and did keep a camera. And there's actual pictures of my dad coming in on his tank with the German eagle above the gates, and his face is very recognizable in this additional pictures that we found, and we just found those 2 years ago.
Wow, amazing. Did your father face any serious repercussions for what I suppose in the strictest sense of the word amounted to refusing to obey orders, disregarding very clear orders and choosing to do something else, something, of course, which, of course, now we all fully applaud. At the time, did he mention that there were any repercussions whatsoever or?
No, the interesting thing is, very fortunately. I mean, it was clearly a court-martialable occurrence for him denying orders. But what we later found that some of the people who were in the background barking orders not to go in, once they found out what really happened, over those next few years, were claiming credit for giving the directions to go in. And he really wasn't recognized as the true liberator of Mauthausen until, sometime in the 70s when the truth really came out and people realized who he really was, because he had received a number of letters from people who survived, who were there, who remembered him. Mm. And they found his address here in the States and annually would write letters of thanks. And ultimately, they recognized him as the liberator, and they've put up a plaque in Mauthausen with his likeness on there.
Wow. So if anybody would know of who was primarily responsible, it would be those who were actually liberated by him and his 23 men.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that your father was invited back to Mauthausen. Tell us when that occurred and what you know about it, and if your father had any reluctance about returning to the scene of such horrors.
No, he was invited in 1975. He was very honored that they wanted him to come back. But we were a family of very modest means, and he really could not afford to fly and stay in Europe, and they wanted him and my mother, and there was no way that they could afford to do that. And his men in the 11th Armored Division donated money in order for him to be able to take the trip, and he went there with a fellow that became Colonel Slatin, and so he went on his own in 75. He was the parade marshal and placed a wreath at the gravesite that they had buried there, and was very honored to do that. And at that time they told him that they would like him to come back in 1980, and he did, and at that time they were able to save up enough money, and he and my mom both went in 1980, and those were the two times. And he was just very honored to go back, and the people that certainly remembered him.
Hmm. A last question. How much do you think your father was able to come to terms with the horrific things that he saw at Mauthausen? Was that something he was ever, in a sense, able to process and, in a sense, put to rest?
He could not believe that humans could do what they were doing to other human beings. And it's something that stayed with him his whole life. It was very difficult, and you know, the pictures and things that he saw, and just the pictures in his mind, I couldn't imagine. But it was something that stayed with him his whole life.
Hmm. Well, we certainly applaud his courage and conviction in doing what he did, and are grateful that he was able to lead that liberation effort into Mauthausen on the 5th of May, 1945. U.S. Army Sergeant Albert Koziak. Larry Koziak, his son, we so appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show to share this story. We want to remind our listeners that you will be on hand at the Lake Geneva Public Library on Saturday, the 14th of May, for this special event, which will feature author Wendy Holden, the author of this extraordinary book called Born Survivors, Three Young Mothers and Their Extraordinary Story of Courage, Defiance, and Hope, which includes a stirring account of Sergeant Albert Koziak and the role he played in the liberation of Mauthausen. And Larry Koziak, again, we thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. We'll be there at 10:30, by the way, and Dr. Olsky, one of the surviving babies, will be there as well. So I hope people come out and meet this extraordinary author.
Hmm. Larry Koziak, we thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
That music, of course, comes from one of the world's most beloved musicals, Fiddler on the Roof, by Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick. It opens this Friday night at the Racine Theater Guild. In this portion of The Morning Show, you're going to hear from Doug Instanis, the director of the production, and Davidson Kane and Kathy Berg, who've been cast in the roles of Tevye and Golda. I asked Doug Instanis to talk about the complicated central role of Tevye.
Tevye's a hard role because you have to like him a lot. You have to just want, and I'm, go away so I don't have to just say nice things about you. He has to be very likable.
Should and, I stand and twirl?
Yeah, that's right. And so he has to have that charm. And he has to be funny, and he has to be serious, and he has to be able to sing, and so there's a lot of things that go into Tevye, but I think the overriding character is somebody that you want to watch, somebody that you like, and somebody that you would like to know. And when he goes through hardship, it's sad because you really like these people. You like the family. You like these all the characters in the play. And when they're put in these bad situations, your heart goes out to them. But as I keep telling the cast, the drama takes care of itself. The comedy is the hard part. You need somebody that can carry the... And I don't want this to sound bad either. I can teach someone drama, how to be sad. Everybody knows how to cry and be sad and take a pause, and you can block that. Comedy, you can't. Comedy, you have to feel. Mm. And you have to enjoy that and enjoy life and be bigger than life. And so I think all of those wonderful things Davidson is great at. He's had a number of larger-than-life roles on stage where he's, you know, had comedic roles, and he's had some heartfelt roles. So he gave a really good audition. So he had a lot of good things going for him.
So Davidson Kane, he's been in a lot of things at the Theater Guild. A lot of people remember you as a really despicable character in Les Mis when you played Thénardier. And so this, of course, is poles apart from that role. How long have you dreamt about the possibility of portraying Tevye? Is this something you've dreamt about, thought about for a long time?
You know, the only real exposure I had to Fiddler on the Roof before performing it was I think I saw the movie about 15, 20 years ago. And when I was in high school, we did, in my choir, we did a medley of Fiddler tunes. So we did like Matchmaker and Sunrise, Sunset, and If I Were a Rich Man. So I already knew those songs, obviously. But I knew when I saw it come up on the schedule, I said, this isn't right in my wheelhouse. I mean, Tevye's the right age. I'm the right, you know, girth.
I said he was bigger than life. Right. I didn't mean it that way.
But you know, and so, you know, I was, of course, very grateful to get the part. And when I just started reading it and started really getting into the character, I started realizing that I am Tevye in a lot of ways. I mean, I have four kids of my own, and one of them is about ready to march off into the world, and not just march off into the world, but, like, travel. He wants to go halfway across the world. So it's like I'm starting to really start to feel a lot of the same things that Tevye feels. So being able to relate to this character became very easy, very easy for me. Yeah.
Wow. One of the challenges of it is it's a huge role. And this is a, I think you called it a book-heavy musical in that, I mean, it has lots of great songs, but it actually doesn't have as many songs as some musicals. It has, and on the other hand, tons of spoken dialogue. And Tevye is by far the largest role. I mean, have you ever had a role as large as this?
No, I don't think I have ever had a role where I had this many lines. I mean, when we did The Werewolf's Curse last year, I played seven different parts, and I had a lot of lines, but I don't think there was a lot. It wasn't, definitely was not this kind of character, that's for sure. I mean, that was a little more of a romp, but yeah, I don't think I've ever had a role this big. Yeah.
Well, sitting next to you is the woman who was cast as your wife, Golda, Kathy Berg. Say a word about the significance of this role.
Well, I think Golda is a very difficult role because on the outside she appears harsh and, you know, businesslike. But she's not. You know, she's a very loving person. And the type of profession I thought, what type of profession would be good at that? A teacher would be good at that. Well, I know some teachers, and one has happened to try out who has all those qualities that can be firm, but yet the kids would run up and give her a hug and, you know, give her that little apple on her desk. And someone who can push you a little bit, but also can have a really good heart. And also, this has to be a good singer, because there is some songs that, you know, the Sabbath Prayer, Do You Love Me, you know, these are not easy songs. And so you need a person that can sing well, who can be firm, but also be very loving and kind. And so we were very lucky that Kathy auditioned, because she has all those qualities.
And she looks good in the costume, so.
There you go.
Thanks.
So, Kathy, was it? Kathy Berg?
Yes, that
would be. A lot of people will remember you in a very, very different role, as in Glorious, playing the role of the kind of dotty wannabe opera singer Florence Foster Jenkins. So I can't think of two roles farther apart from each other than Golda and Florence.
Yeah.
So what does it feel like to be undertaking this role?
It's, first of all, an honor. I've loved getting to know Golda and feeling like a different role, definitely, than Florence. Florence was a dreamer, and I think Golda is too, but she's dreaming along with everybody else and just trying to be the supportive wife and supportive parent and living to the best that she possibly can to make it a memorable life for those kids, even though they have nothing.
You have, unlike Davidson, who comes to this pretty raw in terms of having not ever been in Fiddler before, you have been in Fiddler before. It was many, many years ago, right?
Yeah, we won't say how many years ago, but it was a while back. I was Yenta the Matchmaker in a summer music camp back in 19...
One of the challenges, of course, for Tevye and Golda and a number of other people in the cast, just about everybody, is the matter of speaking with authentic accents. So, Doug, say a word about the challenge of that and some of the resources that have been sort of brought to bear to bring that along.
We've I've thought a lot about this, and I've watched a lot of different productions, and they've all had varying degrees of who has accents, who doesn't have accents. If you watch the movie, the same thing. I think the overriding similarity is that all of the older characters had fairly authentic accents. The younger people did not. And I thought about that because it talks about change and it talks about the old ways and new things and things are changing and stuff like that. You have to be able to understand what they say. If you're doing a real Russian Yiddish accent for people in the Midwest, it might be a little bit difficult. So what we were trying to get is a flavor of that, especially with the older characters who've been around and are, you know, stuck in their ways. The younger people, not so much. So we were lucky. The Theater Guild many years ago had a relationship with a company from Soviet Georgia, and they came here and they performed, and we went there and performed. And Dolly Miller married one of our volunteers and lives in Racine. So I called her up and asked her if she'd be willing to come in. Now, Georgian is different than Russian, and she is, I think, Lutheran. So she, she's a Lutheran Russian.
Or so she was perfect.
Georgian. That's perfect. But she came in, and she worked with the cast, and she has a friend that she works with that is actually a Russian Jew that has immigrated to this country. So she came in and helped us. And then Kathy is friends with Dmitry, who teaches at Carthage, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And I won't pronounce his last name because I mess it up. Help me.
Shapovalov.
Shapovalov, right. And he's a Russian musician. And so he came in. And he has a very musical ear, and he's a teacher, so he was able to help us. So we had two ladies and a guy come in that really, I think, helped a lot. I think as people listened to it and listened to them talk, because when we were getting Russian, we were getting down here, and everybody was a bass. Mm. And then when Dmitry came in, he said, well, we use a, you know, we have high voices too. And so it was nice to have just listen to them talk, because they're very charming and likable people. And that's what we talk about in the show, that they have to be likable and charming. And so we're very grateful that they came in to help us with our accents. Mm.
So to Davidson and Kathy, what kind of difference does it make in terms of being Tevye, being Golda, to bring that matter of actually sounding Russian into the words that you say? What kind of difference does that make?
Well, you know, I'd heard Alfred Molina, who very recently reprised the role of Tevye, and I think Danny Burstein was currently playing Tevye on Broadway, and they weren't doing the accent. Hmm. But I always thought it was, you know, like when L'Chaim Topol did the role in the movie and in London, and who's, I think he was still doing it about 5 years, 6 years ago. Yeah. he's got this beautiful accent, and I remembered that from the movie, just thinking, just you want to hear him talk more and more and more. Yeah. So that's sort of what I aimed for. And having Dmitry come in and having our other folks come in was a tremendous help. If only to have them say, you're doing fine. Because, you know, when you do all the work on it, and it's like you don't want someone that it's from there to go, what are you doing?
Exactly. How about you?
Well, I'm constantly being coached on my accent at home and and in other places. But I think it's still a work in progress for me, because every night I find a different thing to say differently. And you will find out that I will never say the same thing twice the same way. So
it keeps me on my toes.
I'm trying to keep you on your toes. Yes. So it's I don't mind accents. I've been a mimic my whole life. So I don't know how it's going to end up settling into me yet. It's come and watch, and then you'll find out.
My daughter was asking me the other day, because I was practicing my accent with her, and she said, Have you done a show here where you haven't done an accent?
That's true.
And I had to think about it, because I think since I've been with the Guild, I've done Russian. I did Russian once before in Night at the Nutcracker. I did English for Sherlock Holmes. The German-Bavarian variations for Werewolf. I mean,
Three Musketeers.
Three Candyman. Musketeers, yeah. And then I had to sing in French for Three Musketeers.
So. Candyman.
And Candyman, yeah. So, yeah. So I've been working with accents seems to come with the territory
there
here.
You go.
For me, anyway.
Right. One thing, Doug, about this show, of course, is that it's basically peasants who are singing and dancing. What kind of difference does that make in the way that you direct this show versus Sound of Music or some other show that maybe suggests more elegance?
Well, sometimes I fight with my music director about about the notes, and I always say something silly like, I don't care about the notes, I care about the acting behind the notes. And then Greg always pipes up, well, I care about the notes. And so I think we've come to a nice understanding in this one where, again, they're telling a story, and they're telling a story about their lives, and sometimes the simpler the better. And, you know, you're when someone who is not an opera singer sings from their heart, I think it's moving. It's much more moving to me than someone belting out something when it's not appropriate. And, you know, Do You Love Me? It's a beautiful song. And it's, you know, we talk a little bit of a tradition. If I Were a Rich Man, you know, it's people just singing as God intended from your heart. And I think that, you know, a lot of the songs are like that. I mean, we have a couple songs, Far From the Home I Love, which can be sung as a, you know, standalone aria. But it's appropriate. It's a melancholy song about choosing between your family and the man that you love. So I think in this, it's just about energy. There are some beautiful moments, though, when they sing Sabbath Prayer on a tefka. So we've been able to compromise on the beauty, because there are some just standalone beautiful songs, and then there's some songs that are just a hoot. To Life, L'Chaim, all these guys jumping around, singing, having a great time.
Mm. A favorite moment from each of you. Davidson?
You know, I was thinking tonight while we were listening to notes, I think the wedding is my favorite part of the show right now. I mean, over the course of a show, I'll have very different favorite moments. And one right now, my favorite moment is the wedding. And I think it's because of what you were just talking about. And it's just a bunch of people having fun. And we're all learning. None of the characters really knows how to dance, per se. Mm. And we're being taught how to dance. And that whole, I mean, the energy on stage is just is fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're having so much fun. And everybody, it's like, you don't have to be perfect. Nobody has the pressure of having to get every step perfect, because it's not meant to be that way.
Right. Although we're finally getting it.
We are, finally. Yeah, finally, we're going to start looking too good.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. Fiddler on the Roof opens this Friday night at the Racine Theater Guild and runs for several consecutive weekends. And if you would like more information, you can call the Racine Theater Guild at 633-4218. My thanks to director Doug Instanis and cast members Davidson Kane and Kathy Berg for joining me for this portion of the morning show here on WGTD.